I've got to say this. Your baking came up
really?
When you went to work at Campaign Monitor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, who brought that up, I wonder? When they called you up for a reference and you said that I was good at baking. They wrote that into my contract, you know. Contract must bake at least one delicious cake. And I fulfilled that.
And what, the only one?
I know, after that they were going, why did you only tell her to bake one? Now she's baked one.
So again, this is another relationship thing, is we're used to bringing cupcakes and...
Yeah.
You know, the bakes. Well, why did you stop working? Why aren't you working for me?
Maybe that's why all the developers hate me now, because I haven't baked anything.
Yes, now, expectation management. You start off with this high expectation. Once you start giving people chocolate, you can't stop.
You know what I was going to make? It was these pass cakes and fail cakes, right? So, see, if the tests pass, everybody gets a pass cake and everybody's happy. But if they fail, they get a fail cake. So they're still kind of happy, but with an edge of awe.
So, Trish.
Yeah.
How many blocks do you have?
Maybe six.
Six?
Yeah, so there's my testing blog.
Right.
This one. There's my cake blog.
So trishq.com.
Yeah, cakeblog.hogfish.net.
not cakeblog.com.
No.
Is that already taken, is it?
No, I didn't look it up. I don't know. I don't add all. I don't accumulate domain names like some people. I've got trisharino.com, which is just a blog full of random. I've got my country of the week blog, where I study a new country every week. This week is...
Is that where that comes from? Oh, look.
Yeah.
Cakeblog.com is for sale.
Oh, is it? Oh, they'd charge a lot for that. Look, they've even got a cake on it.
Oh.
Yeah.
You squatters. I hate domain squatters.
Yeah, me too. So country of the week. I can't remember what country it is this week. No, Morocco.
Morocco.
It's Morocco.
So what is with the country of the week? What happens with the country of the week?
Every week I learn about a new country, mainly where it is, because my geography knowledge is appalling, but not anymore. Not since I've done country of the week, since the beginning of the year. So
what's the capital of Morocco?
I don't know. Well, I've been busy this week.
How do you cook Moroccan lamb?
I don't know. I was going to go eat some Moroccan... Oh, man, I'm so behind on this country.
What's in a Moroccan pie?
There's a Moroccan pie?
I don't know. Moroccan. Macaroon. What's in a macaroon?
Macaroons are French.
No?
Yeah.
I just put the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
You're ridiculous. All right. So then there's also my 50 short stories about fish blog. And
does it actually have 50 short stories about fish, or does it have about 8 and then you ran out of interest?
Up to 22.
Oh, it's still going.
Well, it was on hiatus, and I know there's another one, but I can't remember.
Right.
Maybe okay. It's got to be.
So I have more than one.
Yeah.
I do have a few. I have my technologica.com. So try not to mumble and slow down as part of ASMR.
Ah, good work.
/ mothblog, which is all my sailing exploits. I like to think of them as channels.
Yes.
You know? Because I suppose one of the things that interests me at Twitter is, if you might follow me on Twitter, you might notice, what's these moth things that he talks about? What's this stuff he's talking about, the hydrofoil? So when you follow someone on Twitter, you follow them 24/7.
Yeah.
So I understand. And what I realise is when I want to blog about my sailing stuff...
Yeah.
Then the people that are interested in testing really aren't. So I try and cut my life up into channels. So the moth one. I did have one called Soapbox as well.
I remember that.
Yeah, so I did 3 posts and I took it down because it was just... as much as it was my place to go and rant about things, as much as I enjoyed those few posts, it was like... For example...
Have you just mellowed out?
Yeah, a little bit, I suppose. But... one day I'm driving to work and there's a guy and he's got his drumsticks going on the steering wheel of the car while the car's moving. Like, who does that? Anyway. the rules for shotgun. Official rules for shotgun.
Oh, yeah.
That was another blog post. So that was another one, so I took that down. But then I've got there's a few open, there's my testing stacks that are all open source, and there's a few other blogs that I run for other people that I host as well. So there's a couple, but they're not six. And I must admit, I'm really bad when it comes to my test blogging.
Yeah.
It sort of, real life sort of comes away. You can only focus on so many things, right?
Yeah. Not enough hours in the day.
And so at the moment, my priorities are, apart from family and those sort of things, there's work. Obviously, work's quite busy at the moment, as all testers on big testing projects should be normally be quite busy.
Yeah.
Then there's the keeping my number one spot on SQA.stackexchange.com.
Yeah, that, highly important.
No, highly important. And if you remember the last show we talked about footprint.
Footprint, remind me.
As in, we talked about for a resume, I would normally Google someone and look at what their internet footprint is. One of the reasons why I sort of said when that site came live, I wanted to set myself a goal of being. A little segue. When superuser.com went live, I just happened to get it on the beta and got to top five and was in the top page of the users.
Yeah.
I'd like to just blow 3,000 rep and sort of, it was consuming a lot of my time. And I stopped. When the new SQA.stackexchange.com came live, I sort of said to myself, okay, I know how to play the game from a points game because I've done it on superuser.com. Out of any of the Stack Exchange websites, the one which is my day job is the one that should be important to spend time and focus on.
For sure.
There's multiple prongs to try and get out in the community, and this is just one of them. So, you know, also looking at talk at conferences, which I know you'll be doing shortly as well. Have we talked about that?
Did we? I thought we did.
Yeah, I thought we did too. It's been a while. It's been, you know, almost a month or so now since the last show. More than a month. It's been 5 weeks. No! Oh, going by the secret!
Hasn't it been about 8 weeks?
Yeah. It's been a while, actually. It actually has flown by. It's been quite a while. So you've talked about that, but it's more so between trying to do conferences and blogging and tweeting in things like Daily Testing Tip or writing for, I think, Anne-Marie Charest. She's just everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, she's busy.
Everywhere. So, again, it's a way of trying to build profile. It's interesting. One of the questions that came up on the meta for the Stack Exchange site was, oh, James Bark's here.
Yeah.
Shouldn't he straight away be number one?
For not answering any questions?
Yes. Because, and it's reputation. Well, it's reputation, you know. It's like, you know, if Steve Jobs turns up on apple.stackexchange.com, shouldn't he just be number one user straight away? My point is that everyone that is in air quotes famous or actually has a profile, they've had to build it at some point.
Yeah.
So are you going to say that everyone, if you're a high profile tester, generally from just being loud and opinionated, really, that's how a lot of it comes, or just having podcasts and just rambling on about nothing, should just because you're loud and opinionated, I'm not saying. Clarify, not saying James is, I mean, she just happened to be talking about those things in close proximity. If someone is loud and opinionated online, does that mean that ultimately they should be the only person that is deemed to be a high-profile someone? I don't think it should.
No, but it does end up that way, ultimately.
Well, you saw one of the key questions where James jumped on there. He didn't even answer the question. He was on a rant about something else, and everyone's going, oh my God, it's James Bark. Vote up.
Yeah.
So I felt a little bit annoyed about that, but hey, I got over it in about 30 seconds, but it's okay.
Hey, still number one.
I'm mellowing in my old age. So yeah, it's getting where you're spending your time. So you obviously spend your time cooking cakes.
Not anymore.
What do you mean not anymore? It's in your contract. It's in your employment contract.
No, I only had to cook one.
Only one?
I cooked quite a lot of them, and then I stopped driving into work and I didn't want to carry cakes on the train very much.
So did I tell the full story about how that came about?
Fullview is a boutique design studio that fuses creativity with strategy to create effective graphic design for web and print. To find out more about their work and services, go to ful-vue.com.
If you like the show, and if you don't, please jump on iTunes and give us a good rating.
Well, jump on Facebook and be a fan of our Facebook.
Now, since last show where we mentioned this, Trish, have you gone to the fan page? And no.
No.
Right.
I've been very busy between these two shows.
Yes, of course you have. What was I going to say? So if you can do that, it'd be great. We're also looking for sponsors, so if you want to sponsor the show, jump online. You can sign into our campaign monitor mailing list, which you actually probably should think about seeing if there's anyone on it. We're also sending stuff back.
That's a good point. I'll get on that.
Yeah, we actually might start sending something back. So there's that. If you can do that, that's great. And just tell your friends, tweet about it.
Tell people.
And give us feedback too.
Yeah, definitely. Love to hear the feedback.
Follow us at Testcasters and tell us how much you hate us.
Yeah, in 140 characters or less.
Or if you want, you can write glowing blog posts about telling about how much you like the show. And that's really appreciated for those.
Definitely appreciated.
Man, I couldn't fit through the door. My ears, bang, my head was so big, banging into things.
Look what you've done.
I know. Look at the poor Trish. You can't, every time I move my head, you hear that.
It's painful.
It's quite funny. Okay, we digress. So, test data.
Yes.
When is it appropriate to use production test data? Or when is it not appropriate to use production test data?
Not appropriate to use production test data.
This isn't an interview question. I know we've done a lot of those in the last.
Oh, good. I wouldn't want to think there was some sort of job on the line here.
No.
Okay, so it's not really appropriate to use production
test data. Potentially there could be.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
I'll come back to that. I'm going...
Anyway,
yes.
It's not really appropriate to use production test data. Well, if there's some kind of legal privacy issue concerned with the production test data involved, in which case sometimes I know some organisations will get around that by getting testers to sign some kind of like a legal consent form type of thing, which I know I was on a project once with medical test data that I had to sign something to get around that, and then I was allowed to use... sanitized test data, which just meant that they sort of randomized the data around so that people's names weren't necessarily attached to their personal
obfuscated details. So, things like that, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes they alter it slightly so that it doesn't quite look the same. In that case, you can get around that. When is it also not appropriate to use production test data? When there's a chance that your testing is going to somehow affect... the people that are in the production test data. For example, in my system, if I want to use production email addresses, I have to make sure that I'm not actually going to email anybody at those addresses, because that would be spamming and that would get us in a whole lot of trouble.
I wouldn't want to even accidentally do that. You know what I mean? Like, if the danger of you, even though you're not going, you accidentally doing that is just weird. I know a lot of situations where, particularly where big volumes of data of certain domains is required, where it's not that you would only use production test data, but there's just some scenarios you get with production test data that you're never going to get.
Yeah.
Particularly if you've got data going from between multiple systems and there's different validation rules and things like that, whether it's holes in data or data's largely is big chunks of being incorrect or invalid.
Yeah.
So a perfect example is... if you've got an online system for collecting addresses, you might have two or three address lines, a suburb or a city that may not be filled in. It may be filled in, may be filled in with junk, it may not be filled in. So that the data may or may not be appropriate. You know? So if I know the system, I'm just, unless I'm trying to explicitly do negative testing tests, for example, validation. If I don't use real production or production-like data, I could be just going what I call happy path. Right? Oh, yeah, it's a valid, yeah. Valid address. There's always using valid addresses and not putting in blanks or anything's wrong or things like that. So I think a lot of times when using real production data, you will find those things.
Yeah, definitely.
It's happened another thing with volumes as well.
So. Oh, definitely volumes, yeah. I mean, I once worked in a place where... I came at the end of the project and they were using some sanitized production data, but they only used a small sample of it. And then the moment they put the actual production data into the system, the whole system just slowed down to a halt because it just couldn't handle the volume.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the things where I've seen, you know, on projects where production data wasn't available, to actually go and generate production-like volumes, it's particularly if it's... you can't. So, for example, if you're trying to test a SQL query, you can't just take the one record and chuck it in there 10,000 times.
Yeah.
So if I go select from custom where name equals Trish, and I've got Trish in my test data, it's going to be either a million records come back or no records come back.
Yeah.
So you've got to start having data that looks real. So part of what I've done, particularly with automation, so the hybrid, the approach which I normally try and use is a hybrid. So there's a bottom, if you like, base set of data, which is either production captured or generated or pre-existing. So particularly if you're doing an upgrade, so if I'm working on version 2, we've already shipped version 2 of a system, I'm doing version 3, and I know there's going to be a data conversion.
Yeah.
One of the first things I'll probably do, ideally, I like to cheat. If you want to make something really hard, really easy, you do it again and again and again and again. So what I might actually do is do that upgrade process as part of every daily build or every daily deployment. So deploy version 2, run it through the migration to version 3. So that gets, might get your base set. And then I want to, if you want to put stuff on top. So, or if you've got an empty system which hasn't shipped yet, you want to put stuff on top. So then what I've done is I've got a bit tricky about writing generators to generate data that is truly random but looks like real data. So I guess it's interesting.
That's a tricky exercise.
It is, and there's some very quick wins, which I've used a lot, and then it becomes a very slippery slope.
Yeah.
So the quick wins are names.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to use names. So there's a couple of records, and I'll put some links in the show notes, but there's one of American census data.
Yeah.
And I think there's a couple of lists of the American census data of both surnames, So you're going to, if it's American, you get lots of, you know, that particular mix is going to be lots of Caucasian, Anglo-American, and Mexican names.
Yeah, only that.
Lots of Mendezes and things like that. So that's just what the American data set looks like.
Yeah.
And the same with first names. So I use that as sort of a base set. So use some of those. So use that as, and so then essentially it's huge arrays. And what I might just do is actually come up with two or three arrays or data files where I might have 100 first names. And normally the testers' names get thrown in there as well in the mix. And 100 surnames.
Yeah.
And then so when I want to create a name, I'll just go random first name, random last name, chuck it together.
Yeah.
So that theoretically gives you 1,000 combinations.
Yeah.
Now, to then make it truly unique, I normally then generate a 6-digit or 6-letter, alpha, not numeric, so a 6-letter alpha. So it might be, for example, Bruce McLeod, XXXB, whatever, the randomly generated, and then chuck that on the end so that there won't be name collisions, so it will be truly unique, and it can run again and again and again every time. And your brain sort of just turns off that last piece of the uniqueness, so I can do it, so I can turn it on or off. So straight away, I can generate names that look like real names.
See, the interesting thing with that, though, is that I sort of went down that path when I was trying to generate names as test data. Mm-hmm. When I went and looked at the production data, there's a huge difference between the sort of names people actually have and the sort of names people put in the forms.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be initials, they may be just completely strange things like their company name. They might be funny characters.
I completely agree, and this is when I think the difference between a public internet system like you've got versus an internal system. So if you're building an internal system, say for example the internal phone directory, you're not going to have Bob J or Bib or JJ or...
It's unlikely, yeah.
Those names are unlikely. Whereas Michael Jones or Tom Fredrickson are more than likely. The data's going to be full, whole, complete data. So I suppose there's a project that we worked on for the Queensland Government around And I think this initial project was going to be the sort of people that was targeting this project initially thought was, we use a CRM system.
Mm.
But what they found is the type of system that we were working on, the people that were beginning to be stored in this system were actively seeking not to be stored in the system.
Yeah.
So the exact scenario you talk about is exactly what was happening.
Right.
Lots of aliases.
Yeah.
Lots of impartial names, lots of random witness accounts where people just didn't want their name on the records. So the data is, by definition, almost never going to be complete. So, so that actually is true. Again, I think the system, it would be appropriate for the system. So what I would probably do in your case is, again, look at that production data. Let's try and get a feel for the sort of patterns that emerge.
Yeah, for sure.
So
if you can't use production data.
So what I wouldn't do, related news segment, so in the news, cue the news music, in the news recently, I saw a blog post a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
I saw a blog post recently about an iPhone developer, and in his application, he had a passcode. So you go into your iPhone, if it's locked, you put your PIN code in.
Yeah.
You then go into his application, and it was secured.
Uh-huh.
So he had a PIN code.
Uh-huh.
He was collecting those PIN codes.
Okay.
Not linking them to a user, but just collecting the PIN codes.
Sure.
And he did a blog post on 10 most commonly used PIN codes on the iPhone.
Ah, yes.
And then wondered why 2 days later Apple pulled his app from the App Store.
Yeah, no kidding.
So when I said to you before about, am I applying for a job again? And you said, no. It's like, make sure you do the right thing when it comes to production data. Or you might need to be applying for a job.
Yes.
So, things not to do. Don't capture data in
applications.
And don't just go looking through production databases to get patterns if you're not allowed to.
No, ask first, for goodness sake.
Yeah, exactly. So assuming you got that permission,
yes.
Look at those sort of patterns and look at, I think there's actually profiling tools that you can point at databases that will basically give you, here are the, so say you might have 10,000 records, but there's only, I don't know, 200 unique things in there. We'll tell you what the most unique things are. So those sort of tools can be quite good. So the other sort of things which I've done some work on around generation was generation of addresses.
Hmm.
So again, breaking down, again, assuming that this is a system where people are going to put their real details in, they're not trying to avoid. I would then do a random number, and I would normally, just to make it simple, I would normally generate it from, I think, 11 to 99.
Uh-huh.
So that would be my street number.
Yeah.
And then I would use the surnames, my surname list for the street name, because streets are normally surnames, so.
Really? Didn't you just get a whole list of street names?
But I already had a list of surnames that in most street names.
Oh, you're just reusing.
So just reusing the same
I suppose they use the same kind of characters.
And then what I found is, again, there's a list of street types in, I think it was a document of valid street types in New York. Right. So they got
Okay. So hang on. Are you just assuming you're testing a system limited to Australia and America?
In this case, I was. It was just Australian. This was purely an Australian domestic system. So, again, it's what I need to test.
Yeah.
Right. This is what the addresses of the system needed to handle what. So I was generating a standard Australian street address. This is the pattern I was after. So number, street name, and then I had a random generator where there was 50% of it being a road, 10% of a street, 10% for a close, 10% for a highway.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would generate that. And then I had a list of, I think, about 50 pairs of actual postcodes and cities. So I get actual valid city postcode or, if you're in America, zip code. So pairs. So it would go 10, Frederick, Road.
Oh, this is almost the type of logic
Newcastle
you have to use for my random sandwich generator.
Random sandwich generator? Please explain.
Well, it's almost like generating test data. It's just that we have an application that orders lunch for us at work, and usually we order sandwiches, and sometimes I get a bit bored with the sandwiches. So I made a tool that would, in order to teach myself some Ruby mainly, I made a tool in Ruby that would generate a random sandwich for me. But the reason it reminds me of that is because, first of all, you have to have a different type of bread.
Yes.
And then you have to have a filling, but you don't want to have the same kinds of fillings doubling up. So, for example, Randwich 1.0 was a little bit unpopular because...
Did you open source Randwich?
I did. It's on GitHub. Randwich 1.0 would give you things like a wholemeal roll with mustard. Or it would give you a white sandwich with... every condiment available.
So what you're saying is you could get a white sandwich with mustard, butter, pepper, cheese, paprika, and no actual filling.
Yeah, and then it got a bit carried away with the fish meat combinations, which nobody was really happy with.
Fish meat.
Okay. Yeah, like
fish and turkey.
Like tuna and ham and. And then mayonnaise and mustard.
Okay,
yeah, you get the idea.
Yeah,
you had to take these things into account, and when you're combining this type of data in a string, you'd have to think, okay, so I want a selection of this type of data and this type of data, but if I get this one first, I don't want to get these subsequent datas.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot more complicated than I suppose it is and isn't, because I would tend to try to keep it simple, but... This stuff doesn't have to be complex. So I think the simplest form of this, it was literally, here's an array of 100 strings.
Yeah.
Pick a random number from between 1 and 9, between 0 and 99, and that's what we're pulling out of the array.
Yeah.
And chuck them together. So it's not hard, it's just, you've got to think about it. so some of the other things that I was quite proud of was phone and fax number generation.
Yeah.
So I'd sort of cheat. Again, it was because I was doing Australia, well, I knew what the area codes were based on our states, so it's where I numbered. But then if I wanted to have a fax number, normally I wanted to have the fax number that was either, and it was, again, there was a random factor here, was either, so generate a phone number. Your phone number might be 02-5555-1234.
Yeah.
And the fax number... it might go 1, 2, 3, 5. So it's trying to do a fax number in close proximity. As they are in real life. So generally...
Is that important for this test data?
No, but it's, again, I wanted the data to look and feel like real.
Oh, okay. Real data. I suppose so.
And so if the phone number was 99, it would then have to work out a way to try and have the number that was close. They can just try to have it an approximate fax number. Again, trying to not have collisions in the data.
Yeah.
So it's close. The other thing what I wanted to do is I wanted to be able to generate email addresses from the names that we had.
Yeah.
So what I would do is I would then have, again, a random factor where it would use standard sort of email addresses. So in your example, it might say, it might do trish@example.com.
Yeah.
Another thing too, or it might go trish.coo at example.com, or it might do trishk@example.com.
Yeah.
Or it might do... I don't know, V-Trishko. You know, if you know what I mean when I say V-, then
I do.
You're a very special person, and you'll... Yeah, if you know what it is, you know what it is. If you don't, then don't worry about it.
V-dash and a T-dash.
Yes, and an I-dash or whatever. And so forth. So, again, there's patterns of email addresses to construct from... So, randomly generate the name, and then randomly generate the email in one of X number of styles off the name as well.
Yeah.
So, that sort of thing. So, yeah, these sort of things just knock them out all the time. And so what it means then is, and again, applying that whole 6 or 5-digit random number generator. And then we had to generate some projects. And so I think you're in the last show we talked about Bacon Ipsum.
Yes.
Right. So that's a perfect example where, and I think Joel Spolsky talked about this as well, have some fun.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
Don't be boring. If you're going to generate stuff, so we had to have projects. So I came up with, I had this thing where it would be evil villains or superheroes, and then either lair or hideout and something else. So it would be, for example, Dr. Evil's underground, little secret underground lair, or, you know, Superman Sky Hideaway, or it would be, you know, Captain America's submarine. So it would randomly pick for project locations. Or that was for, and then that was part of that. That was the facility, I think it was, for the location.
I remember when you were testing something based on families, you or family interactions. You were using the entire cast from Harry Potter.
Yes,
which was brilliant.
Yes, because the domain name, the domain of that, we were trying. We had to have broken family units.
Yeah.
So the system that we're talking about, it was never going to be if a mum and dad had married and stayed together and had two kids and lived as a tight family unit, they would never be in this system.
Yes.
Right? So the system was tracking part of what it was. It was tracking broken families. And it was a perfect example. You had these two parents that were killed and had an orphan, and that was adopted by their niece and uncle. And there was, you know, and they didn't treat the kid the best way, and it got beaten up by another kid, and then he ran away from home to a school, and someone tried to murder him, and you know, all this.
He gets taken in by another family.
Exactly. So, for the domain, it was perfect. And the funny thing was, all the names. So yeah, it's like, why is Bruce on Wikipedia looking up Harry Potter? Oh, that's right. He's looking at Albus Dumbledore, or you know, some exact, you know. And so it was.
Yeah.
Have fun.
And I found that because I tried the same approach. As well with that system, and I found that if you try to stick to a theme like that, often when you're getting carried away trying to force the system to stick to your theme, you can find some interesting bugs just unexpectedly.
Yeah, exactly. And normally that a good story, like, okay, Star Wars is another perfect example.
Yeah.
We have a similar sort of hierarchy of relationships, is that they actually, if there's a lot of depth in those fictional universes.
Hmm.
With the relationships, they're actually real. Sort of, there's brothers and sisters and parents and uncles, and there's a lot of those domains where if you need to test that sort of thing, you have those interactions.
Yeah, and it actually ends up being a really complex user story that you can use.
So it's interesting you talk about that, because one thing that Joel Spolsky writes about with a blog post he called "Painless Software Specifications," it's like, make your specs fun to read.
Yeah.
So he thinks it's like, you know, one day, Miss Piggy was banging away with her trotters trying to type into the system. So making documents so they're not just dry, user A does X, but actually make them fun to read and try and bring a bit of life back into what you do.
Yeah.
And you did that with Clicky Thing as well.
I did, because I was making a tool that would try to click every link it found in the application. So the idea is it would harvest a heap of links from a page, it would put them onto a stack, and it would just keep going from page to page, adding links to the stack and clicking them. And theoretically, it would get through all of the links in the stack and it would click everything in the application. So I thought, just to make this a little more fun for myself, I'd style the output in the style of an old RPG adventure game. So a browser window appears before you. It is cold and empty and littered with the tests that have died before it. I'd say use click on link, just to use the odd kind of terminology. And so it was a bit of fun. When I watched it running, it looked like it was having an adventure.
Which it was.
It so was. It was definitely having adventures, especially before I stopped it going outside of the application. It was having adventures all over the internet.
Here's a Wikipedia I see before me. Here's a John F. Kennedy entry I see before me.
Whoa, don't click that. Yeah, so that was a lot of fun, and I wrote up a blog post about that and recorded a sample of how that was clicking on things, and put it to a nice soundtrack of some old video game music. I think I used Legend of Zelda, probably copyrighted, but anyway.
So, and then did you get the, what is this, customary on the internet, if you don't write an uber defensive post, 10,000 people saying, no, you should have done it like this. Did you get that or not?
No, people were. Oh, no, I got a few people saying, I can see where you would have run into this problem and this problem and this problem. Like, for example, with this, people pointed out, okay, but what happens when you get to a form and you have to fill it out and you can't click on it? And I went, well, yeah, I kind of skipped that because...
In true adventure style, you die.
Yeah, too hard, boohoo.
The form troll killed me and I died.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I shouldn't have gone down that cave. Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Or people saying, well, what about duplicate links? You're just going to go around in circles. So I got a lot of feedback in that sense. Mainly what happened was people were giving me feedback on things which I'd already encountered or thought of and gone, yes, good spotting there, sir.
So I suppose that's a really interesting point which I've come up both from blogging and from this podcast.
Mm.
And that's just because we don't explicitly mention something doesn't mean we haven't explored it or we haven't thought about it.
That's true, but, you know, I don't mind if people are taking the time to comment and
point out
these things. And I'm actually really pleased because it means that they've actually thought about it pretty hard.
So that's not what I mean, but I suppose one thing that I think, again, John Spolkley talks about, especially for high-profile bloggers, i.e. not me, is that you tend to find that there's... No matter if you put an opinion out there, there will be someone that will have the exact opposite opinion.
Of course.
And if you don't try and plug every single hole in your argument, someone will go, ha ha!
Yeah.
But what about the fact that when you're standing on one leg and jumping up and down and then you try and execute the test case?
Yeah.
So the bottom line is if you're that person that's being that picky, don't.
Then shut up.
general feedback or criticism, I think, is generally accepted and liked. But I suppose where it comes to the point where I think there's a lot of people, and I think Marco Arment, who features on the Build and Analyze blog, podcast with Dan Benjamin, he does not have comments, I think, and Gruber and John Gruber and Daring Fireball are the same. They deliberately do not have comments on their blogs because they don't want it to affect the way they push their opinion forward.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting. I can see both sides of that argument. I know from my blog... personally, I prefer to have comments there, even if they are going to pick holes in whatever it is I'm saying. That's perfectly fine because I kind of see my blog as an opening to some sort of discussion, whereas I guess some other people are trying to write more like an article, like an essay type of thing.
So I've got a quick question for you. Do you ever censor comments on your blog?
No, not unless it's spam or something. Even comments that I don't like and I don't reply to, like I think are rude, I'll put them there anyway, but I just don't respond to them.
Is it okay to censor comments?
It's your blog. Do what you want.
I've had, on my non-testing blogs, I've had huge arguments with friends of mine or people that have commented on blog posts.
And
I don't want, because I just don't want arguments through you. No, I'm not going to. It's my blog. I'll decide what I go through.
Well, it's your website.
What about this comment? It was there and it's gone. Where did that comment go? It's like,
it's your website and it's a representation of you. Yeah. You have to be responsible for the material that's appearing on there. Like, actually, I did censor one comment, and that was a comment that my friend put there, but he was just being a smartass. So. So and he told me, you should probably not let me put that there.
So it's interesting. I generally don't do it, but it's interesting. A couple of times I have done it, I've been explicitly called out and going, hoy. And actually, to be honest, a couple of times I've done it is when someone has said something about something and I've deliberately not wanted that information to be public.
Right,
said, hey, but what about this? It's like, I don't want to know. You know, it's like almost like NDA type stuff. Where
someone's going,
what about this? And no, we don't want to be telling the world that.
Yeah.
And someone goes, hey, what about the Clinton? He said that he took away. It's like, come on.
Yeah, well, that's definitely a different issue.